Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Most of the really impressive planting progress during the week ending April 28th took place in the South.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Arkansas, for example, 56% of the soybeans planted. Five-year average is just 23%. And even as you move into the Corn Belt states, especially the southern and western Corn Belt, the numbers are pretty impressive. Iowa, for example, coming in 25% planted. Five-year average is 12%. Missouri, similar at 24% planted versus 9% on average. The biggest jump in planting during the week, though, is in the Mississippi Delta. Mississippi coming in now 52% planted. That's ahead of the five-year average of 35% and a 24% planting jump from the previous week.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Look, I'm not a farmer. I don't even play one on TV.
Representative Mark Alford from Missouri's 4th Congressional District.
But I am an American who understands the importance of agriculture, that our food security is our national security. And that's why, Mr. Speaker, today I rise to express my strong support of passing a robust farm bill, a lifeline for our nation's farmers and for the nourishment of our citizens. My home state of Missouri boasts 87,000 farms, the second highest number of farms in the United States of America. Ag is the backbone of our nation. And through the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, we bridge the gap between the produce of our farmers and the tables of more than 41 million Americans. You see, SNAP is more than just a program, Mr. Speaker. It is a pact with our citizens, ensuring that no truly deserving qualified American goes to bed hungry. Yet it's our duty. It's our duty to safeguard the integrity of SNAP. It is our duty to make sure that every dollar is spent judiciously, reaching only the hungry and not lost to fraud, waste, and abuse. Mr. Speaker, it's estimated that about $34 million per day is lost to erroneous payments, some $13 billion a year, where in some cases recipients intentionally cheat the system to obtain more benefits than they are eligible for. These fraudulent activities strain the program's resources and undermine its integrity, affecting those who are genuinely in need. Our farmers are held to integrity standards through their use of programs like crop insurance. It is incumbent that states and recipients are held to similar standards. With more than 80% of the Farm Bill's funding dedicated to SNAP, any fraud is unacceptable. We must incentivize people to live a healthy lifestyle, eliminate waste, and firmly tackle abuse without punishing those truly in need. That's why, Mr. Speaker, it's time to wash SNAP with a program that is pro-work, pro-accountability, pro-sustenance, and pro-health. That's exactly what Chairman Thompson and my colleagues on the House Ag Committee have been working on. It is time to pass the farm bill that backs our hardworking farmers and ranchers and keeps our food assistance programs both strong and honest.
Dr. Jim Baird from Indiana is a member of the House Ag Committee.
As geopolitical tensions abroad disrupt supply chains and heighten the threat of global food insecurity, it has never been more important to give our producers the peace of mind that they deserve. That's why I'm pleased to see we are making progress on this year's Farm Bill and beginning to move this legislation through the committee. This has not been a simple process. However, I am thankful for Chairman Thompson and everyone on the Ag Committee for their hard work. Over the past year, we have held listening sessions with stakeholders across the country to build on the success of the 2018 Farm Bill and prepare for the future of American agriculture. As chairman of the Agriculture Subcommittee on Conservation, Research, and Biotechnology, I am actually aware of the opportunities we have to deliver new agricultural innovations that will address food insecurity, eliminate hunger, and grow the economy. It is my hope that we can continue crafting this legislation, that we will prioritize agricultural research, that will reduce our dependence on foreign inputs, create thousands of good-paying jobs, and utilize our nation's abundant agricultural resources. I look forward to working with my colleagues on the Agricultural Committee to ensure that we meet the needs of all of our producers and prioritize research that will help America be the global leader in agriculture.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're going to get some tough questions.
Representative Jake Elsey from Texas in a House Appropriations Subcommittee on EPA's Fiscal Year 25 budget with the Administrator, Michael Regan.
Ethylene oxide is colorless flammable gas with a sweet odor that's used to produce other chemicals, mainly that do everything we need, and they clean medical equipment. So I'd like to discuss two recent rules under the Clean Air Act, sterilizers NESHAP rule and the hazardous organics NESHAP rule. These rules have an impact, building block chemical that has a variety of critical applications, including sterilizing medical equipment. They both rely on the Integrated Risk Information System, or IRIS, value for ethylene oxide, which demands a level 19,000 times lower than what we have in our own bodies, 19,000 times lower than what naturally occurs in our bodies. So the first question I'm going to ask, because it's kind of a stump the chump, and I don't want to do that, so I'm going to ask for an answer down the road from your staff, and that is, why has the EPA decided to rely on the IRIS rule for ethylene oxide and ignored other credible and readily available assessments on the state level, like the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, which does what you do at the state level? So I know that's hard to find that information, so if you could reply in writing later
Absolutely.
On. But for me, it's how do you justify using a program that's not authorized by us, by Congress, lacks transparency, and doesn't have any statutory backing to replace the scientific requirements which you have stated is very important to you in the Congressionally Authorized Toxic Substances Control Act? If you can make this a quick one.
Yeah, I think, listen, IRIS is a well-founded, strategic, scientifically sound program that we've used for the underpinning of a number of our rules. And I think it does comply with all of the statutory authorities and all of the transparency that we believe it should. These, I will say this, because we've had a lot of conversations with the FDA and with the industry and understand the importance of ethylene oxide, chloroprene, and others. We don't want to see any disruptions in sterilizing and the like. The decisions that we have made, though, we believe do a good balance of, providing a control technology that can reduce the cancer risk of neighboring communities by 96% while also costing the industry less than 1% of their annual revenue. So, again, I think that there is a scientific approach, a cost-effective approach to reduce what we see as a highly cancerous or cancer-causing chemical exposure.
While that may be in high doses, what we're talking about is your limitation is 19,000 less than what we have in our own bodies right now. So what you're going to do is you're going to kill the patient because that which we use to sterilize medical equipment can't be used because it might be cancer-causing in high doses. That's not going to work, and more people are going to die because of that rule.
And on mandating electric vehicles.
What is cobalt used for in these batteries?
It's a critical mineral that is a cobalt. There's a number of critical minerals that make up the need and necessity of
effective batteries. It's okay if you don't know. It goes in the batteries. It prevents fires in the batteries. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I assumed that you knew. However, using this to force us into an EV world that the American public is rapidly rejecting, 2,700 workers in Austin just laid off at Tesla, which is the best-selling vehicle in the EV community. But this seems like it conflicts with your equity action plan because we're outsourcing our sin. It's almost like we act like when China pollutes that the air just stays over China. It doesn't. It flows over the United States. So while we are harming American jobs, American production, and American national security, we are also violating the very tenets of what you have said is very important to you as administrator of the EPA, and that is environmental justice. This is not a picture of environmental justice.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The commercial cow-calf sector is interesting if we look at it in comparison to the purebred seed stock, stocker yearling, or the finishing segments of the cattle business, in that we don't have to provide the intense day-to-day 24/7 management to it that we do in some of those other segments of beef production.
Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State Beef Specialist, on maximizing profit potential.
Typically, if we think about commercial cow-calf production, we can identify some critical control points where we can intensify our labor and our management into some specific things that are going to lead to improved herd health or reducing the disease, reducing our parasite load, diagnosing pregnancy to make sure we don't incur that annual cost of running a cow without a weaned calf to return on that investment, and in particular, doing things that will raise the value of that weaned calf. But let's look at some specific things and quantify the value of one management practice or another. The reality is in the commercial cow-calf sector, we are often price cycle takers. We're going to see cycles of high and low prices. But in a time like this, we want to manage what we can manage and control what we control. First, if we can get our cows bred one heat cycle earlier, calving 21 days earlier, we're going to wean a calf that's about 40 pounds heavier that following year. In the current market, an extra 40 pounds of weaned calf is worth about $125. Castration. Typically, castrated steers are worth $5 to $10 a hundredweight above the price of an intact weaned bull calf. That discount actually goes up, or that premium actually becomes bigger, the heavier those calves become at weaning. As early in life as possible is the best time to actually perform castration. It's less stressful on the calves. And for those thinking, well, my bull calves are going to outweigh my steer calves at weaning, there's actually very little testosterone surge until puberty. Steer calves weigh up about the same as an intact bull calf whenever we wean them. Growth implants. Growth implants, for approximately a $2 cost, give us a 10 to 20% efficiency gain in terms of growth in those pre-weaned calves. If that translates to around 18 extra pounds of weaning weight in the current market, that's worth over $50 a head, somewhere in the ballpark of $55 per calf. And in particular, if we think of castrated calves that have been growth implanted, those are typically heavier than an intact bull calf by the time we wean. Management practices such as making sure we're raising poll calves, which can be controlled through a selection program, or just dehorning, also equate to a $5 to $10 a hundredweight premium over a calf that sells with horns at the time they're weaned. Final thought is just preconditioning of calves. Bundling a group of practices such as making sure we've got two rounds of vaccinations in calves by the time they're weaned, covering respiratory disease and blackleg. We've dewormed those calves. We potentially bunk broke those calves and weaned them on our farm or ranch for at least 45 days before we market them. We need to be getting on that when those calves are about 2 to 4 months of age. In spring calving herds, that time is now. A lot of evidence that shows, particularly in something like the Oklahoma Quality Beef Network, or OQBN, going back over the last 12, 13 years, the average premium on those calves is about $13 a hundredweight. On a 500-pound weaned calf, that quantifies the value of good management at about $65 a head. Bottom line, good management has never had more value because of the markets we're presently in. Manage what you can manage, control what you can control.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is an absolute honor to be here to support your farm bill, and it's moving forward today.
California Representative John Duarte.
As a fourth-generation California farmer, working side-by-side with my next generation, the fifth-generation California farmers in my family, nothing is more important right now than to get farm security and farm stability for Americans' farmers. As a California farmer, I've got some of my friends right now, best-of-breed friends, calling me, telling me, if we can't get stability in our ag prices, if we can't get our costs under control, if we can't get foreign markets opened up again, this might be our last year. The bank might have us sell property. We're looking at a commercial real estate crisis in America today. Well, let me tell you firsthand, there is a agricultural credit crisis coming in America today because we're on the heels. We're on the heels of COVID. We're on the heels of supply chain disruption. We're on the heels of Bidenflation. Still under it. And all of this is stacking up against farmers. While American families have higher SNAP benefits than they've ever enjoyed before, and so many of us in the farm, the Ag Committee support SNAP program to keep American children and families with robust nutrition, we have produce and protein leaving the dinner plates of working families. We have cereal companies today advertising breakfast cereal for dinner. Again, as SNAP benefits are higher than they've ever been, maintain their plussed-up status after COVID. And many of us on the Ag Committee support that, both sides of the aisle. So what do we need? We need a farm bill that produces American abundance, that promotes American farmers' innovations, that allows American farmers to produce for national markets. We're shut out of China with retaliatory ag tariffs. We're fighting back on that. But we need market access promotion. We need the specialty crops block grants plus up to help American farmers and specialty crop producers find the new markets they need. On the Gates Act, we want to solve big environmental problems, big ecological challenges with farming. Well, we need to make sure the biggest farmers can do that. So for those who are true farmers that make over 25% of their income from agriculture, we need to allow the conservation program access irrespective of income limits.
The chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
A robust Title I aids the American producer in managing the risk of low prices or declining farm revenues. On the research side, American agriculture is science, technology, and innovation. The Farm Bill promotes science, technology, and innovation, which are necessary for training the next generation of agriculturalists. It's necessary for keeping American agriculture at the forefront of productivity and maintaining our competitive edge with China. It helps us deal with sometimes deteriorating weather conditions. It helps us in areas where soil health is not the finest and being able to turn that around. It helps us to be able to produce more on less acreage, which is what the trend has been. Trade, incredibly important part of the Farm Bill as well, and the Farm Bill trade programs have worked to build and maintain and expand markets for American agriculture products around the world. American producers not only feed, fuel, and clothe our nation, but provide for consumers around the world. And the Biden administration's trade agenda, or lack thereof, has left America's producers with their hands tied, unable to engage in free trade and pursue new or expanded markets. And so this Farm Bill is an opportunity to bolster those markets.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Last month, the EPA finalized a rule lowering the standard for a particulate matter.
Chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Environment, Mike Simpson from Idaho, questioning the EPA Administrator, Michael Regan.
Aside from my concerns with the agency revising this rule outside of the standard five-year cycle, I'm more concerned that you're shutting down industry and manufacturing in America. In addition to the new counties that will be non-attainment with this lower standard, including counties in Idaho, most of the country will not be able to permit new or expanding manufacturing projects. Then what? We will be forced to import products and become even more dependent on our foreign adversaries, and we will drive jobs overseas and turn our back on American workers, as Mr. Elsie was talking about earlier. A particular issue concerning attainment in our western states is the impact on wildfire smoke. Unfortunately, wildfires will continue to happen and intensify, and our federal and state partners need to be able to continue using prescribed burns as a forest management tool. It is imperative for the EPA to work with the western states to accurately account for these events when determining attainment with the new stricter standards. Just a few weeks ago, the governor of Idaho joined 21 other governors in writing a letter to the agency outlining these wildfire-related concerns, and I'd ask unanimous consent that that letter be included in the record. Recognizing the far-reaching impacts of this rule, the FY24 House Interior Bill included a provision blocking the rule. But at the very least, the states are asking the agencies to pause implementation of the rule until their concerns are addressed. Are you concerned that this rule will prohibit new economic growth throughout the country and will drive jobs and industries overseas? Hopefully you'll surprise me with your answer. Do you think the agency has a solid, fair plan on how to handle events like wildfires and prescribed burns? And tell us what your coordination has been with the states thus far and what you're planning for the future.
Well, thank you for that. I will say that hopefully it's not a surprise, but maybe it is. When this rule is scheduled to the earliest that it can come into place is around 2032, we believe that 99% of all the counties will meet the new standard. The reason we believe that, the first is that we've got an incredible working relationship with a lot of our state environmental regulators, and so there are resources coming from both the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act that's going to infuse some capital in to help with some of these PM concerns that we have. The second is we have absolutely listened to our western states and our western governors and taken a lot of advice on, from a data standpoint, how we calculate the monitored data from wildfires and from prescribed burns. So we have a great strategy for differentiating that particulate matter data that's coming from a very sophisticated air monitoring system that points to wildfires, prescribed burns, and those emissions that we're actually targeting. So I believe with the infusion of capital from Bill, from IRA, from listening to some of the concerns that we've heard from some of the Western governors, and looking at my conversations with the Secretary of Commerce and the President and others who want us to continue to be a beacon of light for jobs and creativity, I think we can meet that goal.
Just remember that prescribed burns are how you prevent, hopefully in the future, catastrophic wildfires. And so if we put too many restrictions on prescribed burns, you are increasing the chances of catastrophic wildfires.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, this latest cattle on feed report showed placements in March were down more than expected at about 12% from a year ago.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
Marketings in March were down even more than that, about 14% from a year ago. And the April 1 cattle on feed number was still above a year ago at about 1.8% above a year ago. But that makes the seventh month in a row we've had feedlot inventories still above this time last year. As of April 1st, the number of steers in feedlots was actually up 2% from 1 year ago. The number of heifers was up about 1%. But the thing we're really watching in that number is the heifers as a percent of the total feedlot inventory. So it's been running about 40%. It was just under 40% in January. This time it dropped to 38.5%, which is a significant drop, but still well above normal. So it suggests that we're still actually feeding quite a lot of heifers.
What about slaughter?
You know, cattle slaughter is down. Again, in total, there's less cattle in the country. So steer and heifer slaughter are both down, as well as cow slaughter. So we continue to see tighter numbers as far as cattle slaughter.
And carcass weights?
You know, one of the things that offsets the decrease in cattle slaughter is the fact that carcass weights are heavier. I mentioned earlier that the marketings from the feedlots was down significantly, and that's one of the things we've seen in this environment. Feedlots are trying to maintain inventories, so they're slowing down the rate of marketing. They're taking the cattle to heavier weights. We see that in these carcass weights. And so with carcass weights being up, that partially offsets the decrease in cattle slaughter. Beef production then is down for this year. It may wind up not being down quite as much as we thought, because it looks like these carcass weights are going to stay well above year-ago levels going forward.
U.S. Meat Export Federation marketing staff from around the globe recently met in Korea, and as USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom explains, the group looked at the explosive growth of home meal replacement kits in the country.
One of the main drivers for red meat consumption globally has been the convenience factor. And when I say convenience, I'm talking about home meal replacement. I'm talking about restaurant meal replacement, prepared meal kits, this sort of thing. And there's a real demand, and there's no bigger demand than what we've seen in Korea. So the opportunity to have our global staff conference here in Korea, it was a great opportunity to really roll out these concepts to some of the other countries around the world that maybe haven't seen that demand, at least to the level that they have in Korea.
The growth of HMR in Korea has been driven by consumer demand for convenience, according to USMEF Vice President of Asia Pacific, Jihae Young.
In terms of freshness or the diversified recipe, it's developed in a way that what Korean consumer wants. So what we want to show to the international staff, and then they can get the idea back home and then share what they learned and then develop their own recipe or develop the product that can address their own customers in their market.
USMEF utilizes support from USDA, the Beef Checkoff Program, and the National Pork Board to promote the use of U.S. beef and pork in HMR items in Korea and expanding into other markets where these products are gaining popularity.
We're in a situation, especially on the beef side, with reduced production. Everybody on the beef side globally is asking, what else do we have to offer? You know, my production's down. I can't get enough of this product. What else can I offer? Well, this is an opportunity to add value into the supply chain, even though we have less production. And I think that's one of the exciting things is one of our jobs as MEF is to show options, show alternatives for the marketplace.
I'm John Harris.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yes, those damaging storms that crossed the nation's midsection at the end of this past week did grab the weather headlines. However,
you have to remember that most of the week was wide open for field work in key production areas of the Great Plains and Corn Belt.
And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says,
we did see good planting numbers continuing for most major crops.
The corn planting pace better than good.
Yeah, corn planting really took off for the week ending April 28th. We actually saw 15% of the intended acreage planted just during the week, during that seven-day period ending April 28th.
So corn growers now have 27% of their crop in the ground, 5% more than average. Soybean growers have been busy planting as well.
The national number advancing 10 points during the week to reach 18% of the intended acreage planted by April 28th.
That's ahead of average and ahead of last year at this time, and Rippey says that could apply to almost every major crop this spring. Gary Crawford, Washington.